Everybody, Happy New Year. I'll start with a general overview of the formalities about this course. And then we'll get right into it. So this course on quantum field theory for cosmology is going to have this picture as understanding this picture as one of its key aims. This is showing the cosmic microwave background, a picture that you've probably seen many times. And what are these white lines there? Does anybody know what they are? They represent the direction of polarization of the cosmic microwave background radiation. It's light, it's actually a little bit polarized, and the polarization varies from location to location in the sky. And this has a huge significance for the origin of structure in the universe. That's why I put the picture there. Now, before we get into the topic, let me just say that some general things about the course. The course has a homepage on Learn, but forget about that one. I'm not going to use this one. Instead, I set up a homepage of the course. If you go to my homepage, you just Google me, and then go to the left sidebar, you find under Teaching Quantum Field Theory for Cosmology, and that is the webpage that you then get. There won't be homework. Also, I do suggest homework. I just don't ask you to hand it in. It won't be marked. So there will be occasionally suggestions for things you may want to calculate yourself. There won't be a midterm or a final. This is a course for adults. And the grades will be on the basis of a project. And the project should be fun. It's going to be about quantum fluctuations in fields. Quantum fluctuations in fields in the vacuum, in Minkowski space, but also in curved spacetimes and in expanding spacetimes. I wrote up instructions about how to go about with the project, but I will improve those instructions. Let me show you what we have here. So here on the homepage of the course, it says project. And then if you click on project description, you get a fairly detailed explanation of what's expected there. In principle, you should be able to start with the project within about 2 or 3 weeks with some of the elementary things that we do at the beginning. And then for the curved space stuff, that will come towards the end of the term. And the project is only due towards the end of April anyway. Still, I wouldn't leave it to the last minute to do the project. Okay, lecture notes will be posted here. And today's lecture notes are already posted. I'm experimenting with the format a little bit. At the moment, what is posted here is one slide, one page. Last term, I posted 2 slides per page. Let me know what you like better, and I'll post it that way then. Also, these lectures are going to be recorded, and as soon as the first recording is finished, I will be able to figure out what the URL of that is for all of the recordings for this course, and then I will post it here so that you can catch up if you miss a class by going to the video recording. textbooks. So the lecture notes will be fairly detailed and in principle self-contained. There should be virtually everything in there. But of course, I encourage you to read textbooks anyway, because there is always more. There's always other interesting stuff that I won't have time to get into. There are many textbooks, well, not many, but, you know, like 5, 6 textbooks that you may want to look into. There's one of them that we will follow quite closely for a while in this course, especially at the beginning, and that's this one. This book is written by Mukhanov and Vinitsky, and I got a preliminary version of it electronically, and it is linked to over here. Where is it? Ah, there, this one. If you click here, you get a PDF file of pretty much that book. What is nice about this book is, apart from Mukhanov being one of the main researchers in inflationary cosmology, what is nice here is that it has exercises with solutions in the back. So you can really work with this book quite well. I also brought some other books that you may want to look into. There is the one by Wald, the one by Fulling, and another one by Parker and Thomas. And there's a few more books listed over here, and especially these two are introductions that are available on the archive. Also, I taught this course 2 years ago in the same room. It was also recorded, and you can already preview a few things there. I tend to tinker with the lecture notes, so better get the new ones instead of the older ones. I always tend to change the course a little bit. Okay, any questions about formalities so far? No? Okay, so what about the contents then? Well, I will start today with a historical introduction, but just briefly to get to the point. This course is going to be an introduction to quantum field theory. But there are two kinds of applications of quantum field theory, and correspondingly, introductions to quantum field theory are taught in two very different ways. It's always the same theory, but because the applications are different, the way it is introduced can be quite different. The standard introduction to quantum field theory that you find at most universities, most of those courses will teach quantum field theory for particle physics. The aim there is to introduce the standard model of particle physics. And therefore, quantum field theory is introduced in such a way as to explain how to quantize bosons and fermions, how to renormalize in interacting theories, how spontaneous symmetry breaking works, and how, for example, anomalies work. An anomaly is when a classical theory has a symmetry, but the quantum fluctuations don't respect it, and then you get a breaking of that symmetry. That's an anomaly. So things like that are super important for the standard model of particle physics. They describe, that's the theory that describes the interactions of protons and electrons, well, the quarks that make up the protons and the neutrons, and, well, the entire zoo of all sorts of interactions, such as electromagnetic interaction mediated by photons, the electroweak interaction, the weak interaction mediated by W and Z bosons, and the gluons for QCD, and so on. There's a lot to be said there, and we will cover none of that, because we're going to go into another direction, namely quantum field theory for curved spacetimes. There, the interest is not in how particles interact with each other, what kind of forces they have between each other. All that stuff is important, but for the purpose of what we are considering here, we are studying quantum field theory on curved spacetimes. So it's the interaction of quantum fields and the particles that they describe, not among each other, but with gravity. So we will study how the presence of curvature affects quantum fields, how the presence of singularities and horizons affects quantum fields. So in particular, we will study three key applications of quantum field theory in curved spacetime. One of them is the Unruh effect, one of them is the Hawking effect, and the other one is inflationary cosmology, which is the main goal at the end of the course, which is why it's called quantum field theory for cosmology. So the first of these effects is the Unruh effect, and it will teach us something about the nature of particles that could not be seen in particle physics for in quantum field theory for particle physics. The Unruh effect tells us that observers that are accelerated will see particles, even when observers that are inertial don't. So even in an inertial Minkowski space vacuum, accelerated observers will see particles. Or just to bring it to a point, what is a particle for one person, for one observer, may not be a particle for another. The very existence of particles can be observer dependent. So that's the Unruh effect, and it is describing non-trivial effects of acceleration. And so accelerated observer may see particles where non-accelerated observers don't see particles, and vice versa, by the way. Now, via the equivalence principle, accelerations are very closely related to gravity. And that's where the Hawking effect comes in, which is, of course, the phenomenon that black holes radiate, generally. I mean, it depends on how much angular momentum, how much charge, and so on. But generally, black holes radiate. And that is, again, a quantum effect that is described within quantum field theory on curved space-time. It's not as well understood as the Unruh effect. But we'll see how far we get with this and where the open questions are and where the research is going at the moment. And then there's inflationary cosmology. Now, inflationary cosmology is about applying quantum field theory to the very, very early stages of the universe. Like 10 to the minus 29 seconds in. Now you may wonder, well, okay, that's going to be some sort of ivory tower, very remote, never to be measured exercise, but that's not how it is. Surprisingly, the Unruh effect, not been measured yet, at least not in a clean fashion. Hawking effect hasn't been measured yet. But the predictions of inflationary cosmology have been, at least it looks like that. We have pretty good confidence that we can explain this picture with inflationary cosmology. It's the current standard model, not of particle physics, it's the standard model of cosmology. The claims of inflationary cosmology are outrageous. But they panned out. These predictions were made before the measurements were made, decades before the measurements were made, and they pan out. So what are these outrageous predictions then? Well, the predictions of inflationary cosmology are many, but the one that I find most fascinating is the prediction that, or to be honest, the post-diction, it's prediction in terms of the history of science, but it's post-diction in the sense that the Big Bang is a long time ago. The prediction is that quantum fluctuations in the very, very early universe, first tiniest fractions of the universe, these quantum fluctuations were stretched out by an initial enormous acceleration of the expansion of the universe, so that quantum fluctuations that had wavelengths, structures, just about five orders of magnitude larger than the Planck length, were stretched out within, again, a fraction of a second to cosmological scales, millions and billions of light years across. And then those quantum fluctuations started to seed the early universe, started to imprint inhomogeneities in the mass density of the early universe. And those initial primordial inhomogeneities in the universe are then thought to have led to the condensation of galaxies, and then within the galaxies of stars. Now, if that picture is correct, then from our knowledge of how to calculate the statistics of quantum fluctuations, well, at least after the course, you should be able to do this. So from being able to calculate the statistics of quantum fluctuations of fields on an expanding background, we should be able to predict what these initial fluctuations were in the universe, and therefore how they should show up in the cosmic microwave background radiation as temperature fluctuations and as polarization fluctuations, these white lines there. And since they then led to the condensation of hydrogen into galaxies, just these tiny initial inhomogeneities meant already that where there was an overdensity, more matter would congregate there, and where there was an underdensity, matter would flow away from. So that we should now be able to also predict what the statistical distribution of galaxies today is. Now, these calculations were done ages ago. They started in the early 80s. And the measurements of the CMB are only about 10 years old. I mean, with any accuracy. And there have been competing theories too, trying to explain where the structure in the universe came from, where the statistics of the distribution of the galaxies came from, where the statistics of the distribution of temperature in the CMB came from. But inflationary cosmology is so far, by far, the best explanation. The curves that were predicted there are pretty much what is being measured now. So as outrageous as it may sound, apparently that's how it was. At least as far as we now know. And I guess what it means is that even though it may not be the final theory, what supersedes inflation will have to be even more outrageous. We can't go back on that. This is at least as wild as it gets. Okay, so we will cover the Unruh effect, we will cover the Hawking effect, and we will cover inflationary cosmology. And at the beginning, we will just introduce quantum field theory. If you've done quantum field theory before in a course for particle physics, you will see some similarities, but we will pretty soon, after the beginning, we will deviate and go towards curved spacetimes and all the nice things that I talked about. Okay. Let us start then. I thought I'd start with a historical introduction just to place everything in context. Okay. And at any moment, ask me questions if you like. No problem. Okay, historical background. Let's go back more than 100 years, the year 1900. In the year 1900, things were at a crossroads. Classical mechanics was in deep trouble. Classical theory in general was in deep trouble. And the reasons were several. There was black body radiation, the so-called ultraviolet catastrophe. People had noticed that everything is radiating light all the time. You are radiating light right now. For example, if you hold your hand close to your cheek, you can feel some warmth there. You can feel the warmth of your hand. That's not because your hand is warming the air and the air is warming your cheek. It's because the molecules in your hand are in motion and they carry charges and they will induce electromagnetic radiation, heat radiation, which then you feel on your cheek. For example, when you are at a fireplace, hopefully you have one in this kind of weather, then you can try this. If you're close to the fireplace, you may feel the heat on your skin. But just take a sheet of paper and put it between you and the fire, and the heat is gone. So it's not that, you know, the fireplace is heating the air and then the air is heating your cheek. It's really the heat radiation that hits you directly. So that sort of thing had been known in 1900, but in 1900, they, for the first time, were able to measure that spectrum. You see, it's not easy to measure that because it's in the infrared. Most of it is in the infrared for normal temperatures. If you crank it up to 6,000 Kelvin, then you get white light. That's why the sun is white. By the way, it doesn't look white. Why is it white if it doesn't look white? Does anybody know? It's because, well, you see the yellow of it, but the rest of the sky is blue. If you put that together, it's white. See, it's just that it's scattered differently, the yellow and the blue light. Anyway, they measured it for the first time and they found a beautiful curve, the Planck spectrum, and it was nothing like what classical theory would predict. Because classical theory predicted that the spectrum would diverge, that light of very short wavelengths would be emitted at an enormously high rate. And it's basically because of equipartition. If you remember from statistical mechanics, every degree of freedom is supposed to get 1/2 kT. At a temperature T, every degree of freedom gets 1/2 kT. So in particular, the electromagnetic radiation field has a lot of modes, and every mode for every wavelength, you should expect 1/2 kT. And there are way more short wavelength modes than there are long wavelength modes. See, in a box, there's a limit to how long a wavelength can be. But there's no limit to how short a wavelength can be, in principle. And so, you have arbitrarily many short wavelength modes, each of them contributing 1/2 kT. So, there should be an infinite amount of heat radiation in a box. And if you open it, it would come out. So, that obviously was wrong. So, something had to give. And what gave is, of course, that classical mechanics was completely wrong. And equipartition is not true. And why not? Well, now we know that each mode of... Come on in. Now we know that each mode of a quantum field, and we will cover that in detail in this course, each mode of a quantum field, so for every wavelength of a quantum field, there's a harmonic oscillator. If the wavelength of the harmonic oscillator is very short, the harmonic oscillator has a very high frequency. Now remember that for a quantum harmonic oscillator, there's a gap between the ground state and the first excited state. And it's h bar omega. The higher the frequency, the higher the gap. And this is what saved us from the ultraviolet catastrophe. Because what it means is that all those super high frequency modes, all those super short wavelength modes, tend not to be excited. Because the temperature is not high enough to lift the system from the ground state to the first excited state. So that's how quantum theory started out, with Planck realizing that if those mode oscillators were quantized, then there was this gap that was protecting us from the ultraviolet catastrophe because equipartition would be violated. It's no longer true that every degree of freedom gets 1/2 kT because there's this gap and can't get there. Also, there was the photoelectric effect that also, in hindsight, can only be explained by quantum field theory. The photoelectric effect is, of course, that if you take a metal in the vacuum and you shine light on it, you can free electrons from the metal. You can evaporate those electrons from the metal. And the surprising thing was that it did not behave like a tsunami hitting a coastline. When a tsunami hits a coastline, the wavelength of the tsunami waves doesn't matter much. It's the amplitude of the tsunami wave that matters when it comes to how much destruction it causes. But then when you shine light on a metal and you want to cause destruction by getting the electrons out, the wavelength of the light is what matters, not the amplitude of it. And that seemed weird. How come that it's not so much the amplitude, the brightness of the light, that matters? No, the frequency was really what is mattering. Now we know, of course, that this is because photons have to individually kick the electrons out. And the energy that a photon has is h bar f, or h bar omega. So the higher the frequency, the more energy an individual photon has, and therefore the greater is its ability to actually kick an electron out of its bound state. So again, quantum field theory saved the day. And again, this is a topic for quantum field theory. That's a topic for quantum field theory. In the first course on quantum mechanics, you will probably not have heard about the resolution of the black body radiation ultraviolet catastrophe, because in ordinary first quantized quantum mechanics, Schrödinger quantum mechanics, you can't explain it. The same with the photoelectric effect is really quantum field theory that's needed there. But then there was also the issue of stability of matter in the year 1900. They were just about to realize, with experiments of Rutherford and others, that matter seemed to be consisting of little solar systems, nuclei orbited by electrons. But it was clear that these little solar systems could not possibly be stable. Imagine if we were actually made out of little solar systems. What kind of chaotic thing would that would, if it was a classical kind of solar system? On top of that, an electron that orbits a proton would be an accelerated charge. It would have to emit radiation because it acts like a little antenna with all these accelerations. So it would have to emit radiation and fall into the proton, for example. For hydrogen. So how come atoms and molecules are stable? Again, it took quantum mechanics to resolve the issue. The answer is, of course, that the electrons obey the uncertainty principle. If the electron gets too close to the proton, its uncertainty in position becomes so small that its uncertainty in momentum becomes large enough to escape from the proton again. So the uncertainty principle puts an end to this infalling process. It's true that when you take a nucleus and an electron from far away, it will inspiral towards the nucleus while radiating radiation. But it will come to a standstill. It will stop doing that when it's too close to the proton because of the uncertainty principle. So quantum mechanics saved the day there too. However, it took about more than 20 years for people to figure all of this out. It was in 1925 that Heisenberg discovered non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And the essence of it, you all know, let me just briefly remind you of this. The essence of what Heisenberg discovered was this. The equations of motion stay the same. They don't change at all if you go from classical to quantum mechanics. But the canonical pairs of variables, like position and momentum, they can no longer commute. They have to be non-commutative. And of course, if you do this, you end up in the Heisenberg picture of quantum mechanics. That was the first formulation of quantum mechanics. And it will be quite convenient for quantum field theory. And then a few months later, Schrödinger came along and discovered the Schrödinger equation, which looks nothing like Heisenberg's formulation. But a few more months later, Dirac came along and showed they're all the same anyway. Dirac figured that this was just a change of picture from the Heisenberg picture to the Schrödinger picture and all of that. But at the time, that wasn't so clear. It took Dirac to figure that out. Okay. Now, quantization implied some fundamental changes. And you are, of course, familiar with those things when it comes to quantum mechanics, at least. But for quantum field theory, they play out again with slightly different consequences. So let's review it for ordinary quantum mechanics first. So quantization implied for mathematics, and I'll get to the physics in a moment, for the mathematics, it meant that since the operators, the canonical pairs of operators, are no longer commuting, that they could not be number valued. Positions could not be number valued, momenta could not be number valued, because otherwise they would have to be commuting. Then you can ask, well, if they cannot be number valued, maybe they can be at least matrix valued, like 2x2 matrix valued, or n by n matrix valued. But that's not possible either. They cannot be represented as finite dimensional matrices. There's a quick way to check that. Those who took my quantum course know that, of course. If you take the canonical commutation relations and you assume that the X and the P are represented by finite dimensional matrices, then you run into a contradiction. namely take the trace of it. So here we have the commutation relations, and we just take the trace on the left-hand side, and we take the trace on the right-hand side. Now, the trace of the commutator of two matrices is always zero, because there is this symmetry under the trace. So the left-hand side is zero, but the right-hand side is the trace of IH bar times the identity, and the trace of the identity is just the dimension of the Hilbert space. So we have that 0 equal to IH bar times the dimension of the Hilbert space. And of course, that is a contradiction. And it doesn't help to make the dimension bigger, because it just gets worse. It's 0 equal to IH bar times a larger and larger number, right? No, the solution is to make sure that the dimension is infinite, so that the trace is not defined in the first place. And that works. It might be surprising, but it's we know, of course, that it does work. But we also see here that it has to work in infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. Now, the physics of it, and the physics of the non-commutativity, is, of course, the physics of the uncertainty principle, which means that there have got to be quantum fluctuations of the canonical variables. At least one of them has to fluctuate. But generally, both of them will fluctuate. If one of them doesn't, the other one will fluctuate infinitely. That wouldn't be physical either. So there's always going to be quantum fluctuations. Now, quantum fluctuations are something that in first quantization, ordinary quantum mechanics, people don't pay that much attention to. But in quantum field theory, they're going to acquire a whole new set of meanings and importance. So we'll get back to those. But the main message, of course, is that because of the uncertainty principle, we have that there is a fundamental notion of randomness in nature. Randomness, or uncertainty, which is not having its origin in our ignorance of things, but which has its origin in nature itself. See, no, we are used to working with statistics. We're used to working with uncertainty. But normally, we implicitly understand that we only deal with uncertainty and statistics because we just don't have all the facts. We just have some ignorance about some data, and that's why we have to adopt a statistical approach. But in quantum mechanics, this changes, because we see that there is no way to improve. There is no way to make the uncertainty smaller. It's not that we have a lack of knowledge of things, but fundamentally, there is an uncertainty there. So nature has a way of gambling. Okay, so it looks like quantum mechanics was solving these main problems, like photoelectric effect, the stability of matter, and the solving the ultraviolet catastrophe, etc. But remember, what I told you about was just non-relativistic quantum mechanics. That's what Heisenberg figured out in 1925, when he was suffering from allergies and he was escaping to an island in the North Sea, as far away as possible from anything flowering. And so he was alone there for a few weeks, and that's when he figured it out. Anyway, so Heisenberg, Schrödinger, and Dirac figured it out, but the happiness was short-lived, because quantum mechanics, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, was very soon found out to be insufficient to describe experiments. And that's because it's not consistent with special relativity. See, even in the hydrogen atom, the ground state has a momentum expectation value, or momentum uncertainty in the electron, which, if you translate it into a velocity, would mean about 1% the speed of light. And even then, about 100 years ago, they were able to measure the spectral lines of hydrogen with such accuracy that it was in contradiction with what quantum mechanics was predicting. they were able to measure the spectral lines with an accuracy that's much higher than 1%. And nowadays, of course, we can measure spectral lines with an accuracy of like 12, 13, 14 digits behind the comma. So non-relativistic quantum mechanics just didn't do it. It was pretty clear from the beginning that that was not accurate enough. So what to do? There were measurable contradictions to Schrödinger and Heisenberg's quantum mechanics. So they needed a relativistic generalization, and that led to the Dirac equation and to the Klein-Gordon equation, among other attempts. We will, in this course, deal a lot with the Klein-Gordon equation because it describes the physics of scalar particles, of spin zero particles, and they have two huge advantages. They are the simplest kind of particle to develop the quantum field theory for, and they are the kind of particle, they are the kind of field that seems to be the one that drove the very early universe's evolution. It just so happens that particles of other spins, fields of spin 1/2, or spin 1, or even higher, just can't do what scalar fields do. So we're really lucky here in that they are both physically super important and mathematically relatively simple compared to other fields. So there were some successes with the Dirac equation, with the Klein-Gordon equation, but there were huge problems with them too. So the Dirac equation and Klein-Gordon equation were relativistic generalizations of the Schrödinger equation. However, the trouble was that, for example, the energy was not bounded from below. And that leads to an instability. You can't have a stable theory when the Hamiltonian doesn't have a ground state, because the energy would just drop and drop and drop while emitting energy, and so it would be like a huge explosion that never ends. Also, it wasn't clear how the unitarity of the time evolution could be preserved in this. And there were things that needed to be described by a new quantum theory that couldn't be described by simply making the Schrödinger equation relativistic. In particular, they had noticed that particles can be created and particles can be destroyed. Quantum mechanics has no way to describe that. So they knew at this point, and that was like in the 30s, they knew something big had to be done. You couldn't just make the Schrödinger equation relativistic. And that new idea was quantum field theory.
Couldn't you use the Dirac equation to describe the creation or annihilation of particles?
Not really. You have to do the second quantization to even get the creation and annihilation operators. Yeah. But basically, they were asking what you are asking, and then they were led to second quantization. So how did that come about? The idea of second quantization, and I'm giving you here the historical way that they actually found it. In textbooks, in many textbooks, you won't even find that history. They will just jump right into quantum field theory and no longer call it second quantization and so on. But I think it's perhaps interesting to see at how they got that. Because after all, we are again in a situation like that. We know that we have to go beyond quantum field theory and beyond general relativity to find a unified theory. And in strategizing how to do that, it might be useful to see how they did a big breakthrough in the past. So what they did at the time, in the 1930s, was this. They made this simple observation that in quantum mechanics, everything seemed to be subject to quantum fluctuations. After all, there seemed to be an uncertainty principle for every operator. Of every pair of operators, you have commutation relations, and you have, if they don't commute, uncertainty principles. And virtually every observable was non-commuting with something, and therefore subject to some quantum fluctuation. So they thought, okay, quantum fluctuations are in the nature of things. That's just how it goes with quantum theory. But they made this simple observation that there's something in quantum theory that doesn't seem to fluctuate. There seemed to be something in, for example, Schrödinger quantum mechanics, in his formulation, there seemed to be something that doesn't fluctuate, something that's completely predictable, something that's completely deterministic. And then they said, that's not very quantum mechanical. This thing is completely predictable, completely deterministic. And that was the wave function. See, the Schrödinger wave function evolves according to the Schrödinger equation completely deterministically. There's no fluctuations of the wave functions itself. You give the wave function at the initial time and then convolve it with the Green's function, you get the Green's function at a later time. No uncertainty about that. Completely deterministic. So what they thought then is, this is just like in a classical theory. In a classical theory, if you know the initial state, initial configuration, initial velocity and position, you can calculate how things evolve. For classical theories of particles, but also for classical theory of waves. For example, you could take a classical theory of electromagnetism. If you know the electric and magnetic fields at the initial time, you can calculate how they will evolve. Completely deterministically. And so they said, Schrödinger equation is just like that, very classical. Maybe we should try to quantize it. Maybe we should try to look at the quantum theory of the Schrödinger wave function. Now, but you see, this was abandoning a quest that they had started out with, which was, let's make it relativistic. They started with the Schrödinger equation and then tried to make it relativistic. Came up with the Dirac equation, came up with the Klein-Gordon equation. But they saw it doesn't solve all our problems. Let's start over again. And so then they started taking the Schrödinger equation, taking the Schrödinger wave function, and asking, can we quantize that? Can we make the Schrödinger wave function fluctuate as well? And they very deliberately said, let's leave the quest to make it relativistic out there for a moment. We worry about that later. Let's first do a second quantization in the sense of quantizing the evolution of the wave function itself. So they did that, and then they came back and said, okay, now let's make that relativistic as well. Yeah?
This might be very weird to ask, but is there an obvious reason why, say, uncertainty principle the IH bar is independent of reference frames? Like when I change basis, right, the operate, like two observers might have different position operators when they measure, but they still both agree that IH bar should be the mean, the right hand side of the commutator.
Oh, there are many things to say about that. I mean, in principle, h-bar, just like c, could be a function. And it could be reference frame dependent. It could be location dependent. And people have looked for that. They have checked, for example, whether the spectrum of hydrogen is the same far away at other corners of the universe as it is here. And you can do that because you can measure, actually, the hydrogen spectrum by measuring the lines, the absorption lines or the emission lines from very far away galaxies. And you can compare that with the hydrogen lines that you see here. And the only difference should be a redshift and maybe some attenuation because of dust in between and so on. However, if the spectrum actually changed the relative spacing between different levels, that would mean the physics is actually different there. To some extent, that happens, but it can be explained by the presence of electric and magnetic fields. This is how we measure the prevalence of magnetic fields out there in the universe, for example. Zeeman and the Stark effect affect the spectrum, and we can measure that, and so we know, oh, there are strong magnetic fields out there, and so on. But we have never measured any deviation from Stark or Zeeman spectra for hydrogen anywhere in the universe. And that has been used to put bounds on how much the Planck constant or the speed of light or anything else that goes into the calculation of these spectra can vary. And there are now pretty strong bounds on the variability of the fundamental constants. So in principle, that's an observable question. Right, so they wanted to quantize the wave function itself and say, this thing needs to fluctuate as well. Why should there be anything that doesn't fluctuate? So the idea was to second quantize, and that meant to quantize quantum mechanics. So the program was similar to the momentum operator in first quantization meaning Schrödinger quantum mechanics, similar to the momentum operator being basically the time derivative of the position operators up to some scaling prefactor that can be set to 1 by choosing suitable units. They said, let's take the wave function, psi of x and t, and differentiate with respect to time, and say that this is the canonically conjugate momentum field to the wave function. And since they then required them to commute, to non-commute, just like x and p in first quantization, and said not to commute, they said, well, it should be similar for the wave function. It too should not commute with its time derivative, and it should have this Dirac delta instead of a Kronecker delta on the right-hand side. And since they had this non-commutativity assumption, they put hats on them saying, well, these guys probably will end up being operators because non-commutative. Now, what was the intuition for this? You see, a key thing that happens when you do that is that you can't be so sure about the value of your wave function anymore. It's no longer complex number valued. Instead, it is operator value. And it could be that the expectation value is one thing, but there will be now an uncertainty about the expectation value of psi. So psi is now going to be having at every location, at every time, it's going to have an expectation value and an uncertainty. And for example, what would happen with the condition that we had earlier, that the wave function ought to be normalized? Take psi star, and the gradient over all of space ought to be 1. Why 1? Well, because the probability for finding the particle somewhere has got to be 1. Another way to say it is that if you add up where the particle might be, well, you find that actually there's 1 particle somewhere. That's the 1. The 1 means 1 particle. And now that the wave function can fluctuate, there's no reason to suspect anymore, to assume anymore, that it will describe just 1 particle. You see, if you calculate something like the norm of the wave function now, there's no guarantee that this is 1, or could be set to 1, or could be set to 1 and have no uncertainty, or could be set to 1 and stay 1, or something like that. So that already gave them an inkling that this theory might be able to describe the creation and annihilation of particles. Of course, it was a long way still to see how that actually is described, but already from the uncertainty principle, they knew something like that may be in the cards. And it turned out that the earlier problems that they had when they just tried to make the Schrödinger equation covariant, that these problems could be resolved, namely unitarity and positivity of the energy, that could be guaranteed with this approach. But you see, what you had to do next was to find a Hamiltonian that evolves the state of the second quantized theory. Because now these guys are not describing wave functions anymore, right? They are operators. They will act on states. And those states will have an evolution. Anyway, so as I mentioned, the psi and the pi can no longer be number value. For every position and every time, the value, in quotation marks, psi hat of x and t is an operator on Hilbert space. Now, it's not the case that everything is going to be wildly different from before. In particular, if you remember, the essence of quantization, as Heisenberg first found it, the essence of quantization is that while you have non-commutativity of the canonically conjugate degrees of freedom, you also have that the equations of motion stay completely the same. Right? Equations of motion are the same. It's just the non-commutativity that changes things around. So in particular, the equations of motion for the wave function should still be the same. Just quantized. Second quantized. So you still solve the same equation of motion. Just on top of that, you now have to enforce that the psi and the psi dot, the psi and the pi, have to obey these non-trivial commutation relations. And what that means is that you get an uncertainty principle of this form, which is, of course, a terrible way to write it, because it doesn't really make sense, because you have a Dirac delta on the right-hand side. So you either have zero or infinity, if you like, right? That makes no sense. But that's what you get initially. A much better way to deal with this is to take your psi field, psi hat field, smear it over some space-time region, take the pi field, smear it over some space-time region, then you get two operators that also don't commute, but on the right-hand side you get something finite. And we will do these things in a clean fashion, and they're super important to do because this is ultimately the way that you calculate the quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field in the very early universe. Of course, we do it properly, not just hand-wavingly here with the uncertainty principle. You can calculate it from first principles, but that's what's behind it. And we will literally take field operators, smear them over a box or some finite region, and then get a proper operator that is no longer distributional like these, and then get proper uncertainty principles, and we find the statistics of the quantum fluctuations and all of that. But the idea of it, the gist of it, is already encoded here. What you also see in here is already the origin of a problem that plagues quantum field theory for particle physics. Now, we're not going to do much particle physics here, but you see the fact that if you don't smear the operators psi and pi, that you have these tremendously large fluctuations there, because you have that, you know, the product of the uncertainty is not just larger than h bar half, but h bar half times infinity. You see, that tells you already that if you don't smear them, or let's say you smear them, but you make it tighter and tighter, you make it more and more localized, then what you get is that your quantum fluctuations get basically out of control. So as you try to localize the psi and the pi, the quantum fluctuations get out of control, and that is what leads to what is called ultraviolet divergences in quantum field theory for particle physics. Once you have interactions, then these things can no longer be neglected. All right, so with this new framework of second quantization, new phenomena are now predicted and described. In particular, first of all, the new theory can clearly describe particle creation and annihilation. In fact, we don't even know yet, I mean, I haven't explained it, how you can describe a situation where the number of particles doesn't fluctuate. Because the canonical thing from this perspective should be that the wave function fluctuates. Whatever you might think of as the norm of a wave function, if such a concept still survives, it doesn't really, then that's going to be fluctuating. So for sure, there should be, the number of particles should be fluctuating. Also, one can predict from this formalism pretty quickly. Dirac did that very soon, the existence of antiparticles. And they have, of course, been seen. He predicted positrons. Secondly, so that, yeah?
Regarding the first point that you're saying that the number of particles uh-huh. must fluctuate, right? Does that mean that you cannot have any system that is like, have infinite lifetime?
No. I meant to say that it looks like the number of particles has to fluctuate. But actually, you can stabilize that. It is possible to write down states of definite particle number. You can definitely do that. Yeah.
So yes. By number of particles fluctuating, you're drawing the analogy that in quantum mechanics, we had psi and it had a normalization.
Yes.
And you said, look at that, one particle.
Exactly.
Because now it's not commuting. Whatever definition of normalization we come up with, there's going to be a delta of psi, which is non-zero.
Exactly. Delta in the sense of uncertainty.
Uncertainty.
Exactly that. That's right. What used to be normalization equal to 1 is now something that fluctuates in general. But it's always a trade-off. You know, you can make delta x very small by making delta p very large. And so similarly, the number operator as well has a principle. It's not trivial, but it has a kind of conjugate variable. And you can make the number operator sharp. So that was regarding particles. But you can also ask them now, how about fields? Well, what we now see is, or what we should expect here, is that even in the lowest energy state of a theory of fields, in fact, in the vacuum, when the expectation value of psi is zero, so when the expectation value of the normalization, so to speak, is zero, when you just say, well, the expectation value of psi is zero everywhere, the wave function is just to be expected to be vanishing everywhere, then you might think, well, that describes the theory of no particle, right? But because psi hat has non-commuting properties with pi hat, generally, psi will fluctuate. So even when the expectation value of the field is zero, it doesn't mean that the variance of it is also zero. The expectation value of psi squared might be finite, might even be large. So quantum fields, even in the vacuum, should be expected to fluctuate. In other words, if you take an empty box, so you pump out all particles, and you make the box have walls that are at zero temperature, because if they have a finite temperature, they're going to put heat radiation in the box. Let's say they are at basically zero temperature. You might think that the inside of the box is going to be completely dark, no light. But that's not so. The electromagnetic field will fluctuate. Even when you try to make sure it's completely dark, no light gets in, you produce no light from the walls, just in the vacuum, the electromagnetic field does fluctuate. By the way, when I was on sabbatical in Australia, I once was in the tea room with a quantum optician, and I said, I want to see that. And he said, well, just come along. And so we went to his lab, and he had what is called a quantum homodyne detector, which is nowadays a standard piece of equipment. I mean, you have to put together some standard pieces of equipment. And we measured that. We measured, or he measured, the quantum fluctuations of the electromagnetic vacuum. You can do that nowadays. In fact, there are people who produce random numbers like that. See, random numbers are very valuable for cryptography. And you could generate them with radioactivity, but who wants to have a very radioactive source, especially if you need lots of random numbers? But you can generate random numbers by measuring the quantum fluctuations in the vacuum of the electromagnetic field. A lot of them, very fast. It's commercial. I think you can already buy that stuff. So even in the vacuum, there are quantum fluctuations of fields. So even when the expectation value of psi, and all of this is meant to be still hand-waving, right? Even when the expectation value of psi is zero, vacuum, and then you put the quantum field in there is zero, even then, you should expect that if you measure the actual amplitude of the field, if you measure the electric field, the magnetic field in the box, you find something like this. And as part of this course, you will see how to calculate that, how to calculate how the quantum fluctuations actually look like, what statistics they have, and how to produce a sample of what you would measure, and how that would change over time if this happens on a universe that expands, just like in the very early universe. And of course, that is a precursor of the picture that I showed you at the very beginning, the one with the cosmic microwave background, right? These are the fluctuations, the vacuum fluctuations, that according to the current standard model of cosmology, were the origin of the temperature and polarization fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background.
I'm curious, that picture clearly has some sort of characteristic dimensions of the waves, right? I mean, there are no really, really short wavelengths there. No, is that a consequence of the boundary, or is that some characteristic of the field that you used?
This is a consequence of me putting in an ultraviolet cutoff.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Yes. But you're right. You see, basically, you take this 2D box here, and then you decompose it in Fourier modes, and then you go to a certain highest Fourier mode. Mm-hmm. And each mode is a harmonic oscillator, you quantize, etc. And then the highest mode you go to determines the finest structure that you can possibly get. Yeah, it's one of the things to explore in the project. And of course, there's also an infrared cutoff. There will not be any waves of wavelengths larger than that if we
That's
do a Fourier decomposition. Yes, because we do a Fourier decomposition of a particular kind. Yes. Okay, so quantum field theory was well on its way. And as I said, there are two different applications now of quantum field theory. And one of them is the application to the standard model of particle physics. And there, quantum field theory is used to describe particle interactions, particle creations, particle annihilations, for example, the electromagnetic, the weak and the strong forces described by Feynman diagrams. If we have time at the end of the course, I will go into the derivation of Feynman diagrams as well. There are key things to describe is so-called screening and anti-screening and renormalization in quantum field theory. This is a phenomenon that you should all know about because it's super important, but it's not part of this course. But let me just tell you in a few seconds anyway, just because it's so nice. Imagine you have here an electron, and here you have a quark. And it doesn't matter whether they're electrons or quarks. The main point is that they have charge, so they interact with each other. And normally they do it this way. The electron emits a photon, which is then seen by the quark. Actually, emission or absorption is not the right term because these are virtual particles. So two charges, like a quark and an electron, feel each other. They affect each other's trajectory because of the exchange of photons. But the photon on its way between the electron and the quark can split into an electron-positron pair, which then recombines, and then the photon goes along its way. This is a higher order correction in the perturbation theory. And these charges here, in principle, can also interact with those charges again. And that means that, in effect, this charge is effectively screened from the perspective of that charge, and vice versa. And what that means is that the overall attractive force between two charges is partially screened by such virtual vacuum polarization processes that can happen in between. Now, clearly, if the two particles are very close to each other, fewer of those processes can happen in between than if they are further away from each other. And therefore, the amount of shielding that these virtual charges can do depends on how close these charges are. And that means that the strength of the electromagnetic force is not a constant. It's not a simple 1 over r potential, like classical theory would make us believe. Not the case. Because of those processes, the the distance law for electromagnetic forces is much more complicated than that. It's a mathematical formalism of ring normalization that explains how the strength of the forces depends on the scale at which we test them. Again, it's super interesting quantum field theory stuff, but we are going to do Hawking and cosmology and so on. Right, and then there is spontaneous symmetry breaking. Again, I hope that you'll take a course sometime about spontaneous symmetry breaking. It's super important because it explains how much of the masses in the universe come about, how particles acquire masses. It's a theory that has a symmetry in its Hamiltonian or its Lagrangian, but the ground state doesn't have that symmetry. Look at this potential. It's completely left-right symmetric. But now imagine that you have an object which is sitting there in its ground state. Well, the object has to sit either here or there, which means that wherever it is, it's breaking the left-right symmetry. So you can have theories which in principle have a symmetry, but the ground state doesn't. And that is nowadays thought to be, the, according to the standard model of particle physics, the origin of masses, actually. The way it was found was, by the way, quite interesting. It was known that if you introduce masses into a highly symmetric theory, you break the symmetry. And that would ruin its renormalizability and so on, lots of problems. That's why they thought, we have to introduce the masses in a sneaky way, in such a way that we don't break the symmetries. And that's a way not to break the symmetries. You see, the Hamiltonian, the Lagrangian, still has a full left-right symmetry, a reflection symmetry. The ground state doesn't. And in this way, you can still reap the benefits of having this high symmetry, but also the benefits of having that this displacement from zero. That displacement basically is generating a non-zero mass. Anyway, right. And then there are anomalies too. I'm telling you on this slide all of the stuff that we are not going to cover in this course. Okay, so anomalies. Anomalies, I mentioned it already today. Anomalies are symmetries that are broken by quantum fluctuations. The classical theory has a beautiful symmetry, but the quantum fluctuations don't respect it. Then you have a quantum theory with less symmetry. And anomalies are generally absent, but can easily happen. And the study of anomalies has been super important in the development of the standard model of particle physics, because requiring the absence of anomalies helps us fill in the gaps in the standard model of particle physics. Maybe we haven't observed this particle yet, or we hadn't observed that particle yet, but it had to exist because otherwise there would be an anomaly and a symmetry would be broken. All right, so that's one kind of quantum field theory, but we are going to do this kind of quantum field theory, namely as applied to the standard model of cosmology. So here the aim is to put together quantum field theory with general relativity. Mostly classical general relativity, which is to say, for most of the course, we will study how quantum fields behave on a background space-time that is treated intrinsically classical. So we assume, for example, that we have a black hole solution, or that we have an expanding space-time, something like that, but classical. And then we look at quantum fields that live on that, and we ask, how are they affected? Can the expansion of space-time produce particles, for example? Can the presence of the horizon of a black hole, can it create particles? And if so, how does it do it? But eventually, when we come to inflationary cosmology, we will have, and that's really great, we will have an opportunity to quantize the metric as well, in a certain perturbative sense. Inflationary cosmology is actually quantizing a certain part of the metric as well. The perturbations away from Friedman, Robertson, Walker, just a sec, a metrics that we will actually quantize, and it's very important to do so. It's not an extra luxury, it's very important to do so in order to keep the so-called gauge invariance of the theory. So a little bit of quantum gravity will do, but it's on very solid footing. It's just perturbative, but it's a relatively safe thing to do. And it seems to match experiments.
According to popular lore, perturbative approach to relativity quantization is not renormalizable. Is that going to be a problem here or not?
No, it's not a problem because, well, ultimately it is a problem, of course, but with quantum field theory on curved space-times, we are super lucky in many regards. One of the reasons we are lucky is that the fields that matter are scalar fields, and they are the simplest kinds of fields to deal with. It's just because the other kinds of fields can't do what scalar fields can do when it comes to the energy momentum tensor and how the fluctuations get amplified through the expansion and so on. But we are also lucky in that we don't actually need to describe interactions in the quantum field. When we have interacting quantum fields, then the issue of screening comes in, as I just explained, or for some theories, anti-screening, opposite of screening. That comes in there. But for the purpose of cosmology, we get away with just describing a quantum field that is being affected by curvature, but we don't have to describe its self-interaction, nor do we have to describe its interaction with other fields. So we can postpone the issue of renormalizability of it. Eventually, of course, it's going to bite us somehow. But for the first order perturbation theory that we need here, we are still fine. Super lucky. Okay, so we will put together mostly classical general relativity, but eventually also we will quantize perturbations of the metric with quantum field theory. And then we will study the effect of accelerations, of curvature, of horizons and singularities on quantum field theory. And in particular, we will study the effect that these things, accelerations, curvature, and horizons, have on particles, but also on waves. In quantum field theory, there are always two ways to look at things. You can look at the field and its amplitude, or you can look at particles. Just like for light, you can look at the electric field, the magnetic field, but you can also look at photons. Now, in the context of the standard model of particle physics, when you open a textbook on that subject, you will sometimes find statements to the effect that what really matters is only particles. Never mind about fields. They're just a mathematical construct. That can no longer be maintained. Over the past 20 years or so, quantum field theory on curved space-time has become very important because of the experimental observations. And from the perspective of quantum field theory on curved space-time, particles are not the fundamental concept. As the Unruh effect already shows, when one observer observes particles, it doesn't mean that another observer will observe particles. They can disagree on that. The very notion of a particle is not a safe thing. It's not something that we can always retreat to. And in some sense, as we will see later, the amplitudes of fields can be more important. The amplitudes of fields contribute to the energy momentum tensor, which curves space. That makes sense, even when there are no particles. I'll give that away already. As I said, with the Unruh effect, we know that if one observer sees particles, it doesn't mean that another observer sees particles. The very existence of particles can be observer-dependent. It goes beyond that. As we will see, in certain circumstances that actually occur in cosmology, in certain circumstances, the very notion of a particle makes no sense. It's not that they're absent, or that they are there, or that the particle number is ambiguous or whatever. No, the very notion of a particle makes no sense. When does it happen? Well, according to quantum field theory, you have to take a quantum field and decompose it, basically Fourier decompose it, and then every mode, every wavelength has its harmonic oscillator. And that harmonic oscillator gets quantized, and you get discrete energy levels, and so each energy level corresponds to another particle added. take, for example, a particular wave vector, particular wavelength in a particular direction, that has a particular harmonic oscillator. If it is in its fifth excited state, you have five photons propagating in this direction. This is how quantum field theory usually works. So the discrete energy levels of the harmonic oscillator correspond to the counting of particles. If you're in the 27th excited state of one of these mode harmonic oscillators, it means you have 27 particles in that mode with that wavelength. But you see, what can happen in cosmology is, because space-time is curved and expanding, what can happen is that these harmonic oscillators that you get when you do the Fourier decomposition are no longer harmonic oscillators. They start out like this, with a potential like this, but with sufficiently rapid expansion of the universe, you can have that these potentials open up like this and flip around. Now you have an upside-down harmonic oscillator. This is what happens when the wavelength of the mode that you're considering is larger than the cosmological horizon. And the cosmological horizon can be very small. It was probably only about 5 orders of magnitude larger than the Planck length during inflation. So when that happens, when the wavelength that you consider is larger than the size of the horizon, the harmonic oscillator is upside down. But what's the spectrum of a harmonic oscillator that's upside down? It's a continuum. It doesn't have bound states. It has only scattering states. In other words, there is no way that you could build a Fock representation and create one particle after the other. There is no such thing as a ground state on which you could build with 8 Dagger applications more particles. It simply makes no sense. The particle concept is lost in these circumstances. But you can still calculate amplitudes. You can still calculate how much the field contributes to the angular momentum tensor, for example. So from the perspective of quantum field theory on curved spacetime, we would say, well, wait a moment, with the particle concept, fields may be more fundamental. Of course, particle physicists don't like to hear that, because for them, working at CERN, all they ever see is particle collision. They never see a field, right? Whereas what we see in cosmology is a temperature distribution in the CMB. We don't see inflaton particles. We see temperature distribution in the CMB, which is ultimately due to fluctuations in the energy momentum tensor due to fluctuations in the field amplitudes. So I guess both points of views are of interest, the particle point of view and the field point of view. So studying the Unruh effect, we will discuss what is a particle anyway. And well, this won't be the inverted harmonic oscillators yet, but it will be already explaining that what is one observer's particle may not be another observer's particle. And then we'll study the Hawking effect, how come that black holes can radiate, and the key question that's behind that, and I'm sorry I can't answer that because nobody can answer that yet, can nature destroy information? Classically, we would say yes. You throw something into a black hole, it ends up in the singularity, the information is lost. No doubt about it. But quantum theoretically, do we really want to go as far as saying that unitarity is violated? There's a big discussion about this, of course, and we'll see how far we get with that. And then finally, of course, we'll do cosmic inflation, where the question is, where did it all come from? What was the origin of the universe? What is the origin of structure? And what's the origin of matter in the universe? Inflation. The standard model of cosmology has tentative answers to all of those things. And it's conceptually quite efficient. You make very few assumptions and explain quite a lot of data with that. Right, so I think we are basically out of time. Just a very brief overview of what cosmic inflation is. I don't know. I don't want to shock you there. All right, I give it a shot. Okay, so this is a more speculative thing. We don't have any experimental evidence for that. But I thought, just for the heck of it, let me tell you where inflation points to. So cosmic inflation is a standard model of cosmology, and it makes solid predictions that can be tested against experiment. But then you can also ask, where does it lead to? What does it suggest? And what it suggests is that the origin of our universe has, I mean, one of the things that, I'm not saying that is the only thing that is consistent with inflation, but what it suggests as a likely possibility is that our universe is not the only one. It suggests that our universe was spawned by a previous universe. You can think of it this way. Our universe could spawn another universe at any time, if there really is an inflaton field there. And the reason is this. If we have indeed an inflaton field, which is a scalar field with a very high mass, if indeed we have an inflaton field, then in principle, that inflaton field might just, for the heck of it, fluctuate locally, maybe right here in this room. It might fluctuate at a sufficiently large scale, a few Planck lengths across in volume, right? In a few Planck lengths volume, might fluctuate so much that its amplitude is so large that the inflaton potential is so large that it's almost at the Planck energy. This is super unlikely to happen because it would be a huge fluctuation, especially for this size, several Planck lengths across. It's very unlikely to happen. But if it did happen, it would mean that this potential of the scalar field acts like a local cosmological constant that's very large. This is what makes a scalar field, among other things, this is what makes a scalar field very special. Its potential acts like a cosmological constant. But what does a large cosmological constant do? A large cosmological constant makes the universe expand exponentially. And not just globally. If you have locally an elevated potential, scalar potential, it is as if you had locally, in this tiny patch, you had locally a cosmological constant that's very large. And what that means is that this tiny little patch will expand like crazy. If the amplitude is large enough, if the potential is large enough, it will expand like crazy. It will mushroom out. It will not displace other things around it. It will create its own space. So you can think of our universe spawning like a mushroom, a daughter universe, which in principle could be within a fraction of a second of cosmological size. That could happen at any time, even here. It's just unavoidable. If you have an inflaton field with that kind of potential, that's always a possibility. Our universe is not stable if inflationary cosmology is correct. And our universe could be the product of such a thing. There could be a mother universe where there are planets and houses and dogs on a dog's nose. This might have happened, and our universe might have been spawned there. I just say, this is where inflation seems to point. It seems to point at the idea that universes can spawn other universes. And then people have picked up on that and they said, okay, so what could have happened is that in this spawning process, because it's a very extreme process, everything happens close to the Planck scale, it could be that, and this goes back to Erikson's question earlier, it could be that the fundamental constants of nature get somehow reset because of the extremality of it all. It could be that one daughter universe has a different value of h bar and of c and defined structure constant, and other things might be different just because of the extremeness of this process. And so you could have universes, spawning universes, spawning universes, spawning universes with different values of fundamental constants, and some of those universes will lead to stars that live long enough to have planets on which life might form and so on. So it could be that there's some kind of cosmic evolution going on. This is just philosophy, right? It's not physics. I'm just saying that inflationary cosmology is the standard model of cosmology today. And what I'll teach you in this course is all going to be solid stuff. But just for the fun of it, you know, if you for a moment take inflationary cosmology seriously, you can ask, what's next? We can't measure anything of the philosophical stuff I just told you. But it's the natural next question. You know, how would inflation start? And so that's where the frontier is in that field. But it'll take us a term to get there. All right, any questions? Oh, and here's the picture of, here is today's universe, an earlier universe where there are lots of gas clouds that haven't condensed yet into galaxies or stars. And here is hydrogen clouds with a few stars or galaxies having formed, just hydrogen clouds. And this would be the primordial plasma. And we are aiming to calculate the distribution of the fluctuations in the primordial plasma. And then the calculation of going from here to there is highly nonlinear physics that we will not be concerned with. It's basically classical physics. Because there you just have a hot plasma, and then you go all that way. There's in fact software already where you can plug in your perturbation spectrum here, and it will calculate that for you. You just plug in the parameters and it will do it for you. There's not much mystery in those steps. Are you working on that?
More so in this direction.
In this direction, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all super difficult. I'm just saying it's not our topic in this course. Maybe you should tell us sometime about it. Huh? All right, that's it for today. See you on Tuesday.